apologies to Cal Raleigh. I wasn't familiar with your rivalry with John Schneider. And I'm sorry that I didn't give you more respect as a Blue Jays killer until yesterday. Guy has 8 bombs against the Blue Jays. He's got an OPS over 1,000 against the Jays. And yeah, that's more bombs than he's hit against any team in the majors. And here's what I was already familiar about with Cal. He's a talker. He's a talker. He's not afraid to say how he feels. In fact, last year at the Mariners' exit meetings, their player exit meetings, he made waves because he basically called out the front office going, a lot of these other teams, if you look at the winners, the good teams, they're buying at the deadline. What did we do? We traded away our main guy out of the bullpen. We're trading pieces away. These other places are making pushes. They're spending money. Are we spending money? Bold stuff. Bold stuff. He had to have his general manager go like, I don't know what he's talking about. We talked about it in private. It was a little different when Cal said it. Like, he is unafraid. I actually love that guy for that reason. He is unafraid. And yesterday, if you missed it, after Cal went yard and officially stamped himself as a top dog Blue Jay killer, he let us in on his rivalry with John Schneider, which, again, I was not aware of. Okay, so apparently a couple of years ago, or no, was it last season? Yeah, it was last season. It was, again, after that 2-home run game, which I didn't remember until reading about his stats on Twitter, going like, holy crap, yeah, I feel like he's hit a couple of bombs. And then they went, no, he's hit all the bombs. He's hit all the bombs against the Blue Jays. So do we have the audio of John? Okay, so I want to hear it in the context, because things, as people complain about on Twitter all the time, are way harsher in the writing than they are in actual audio format or watching the interview. So I have yet to hear John Schneider talk about Cal after that 2-run home run. So let's hear it right now.
Hey John, what about Cal Raleigh makes him so tough to pitch to?
He's not very tough to pitch to when you execute your pitches. You know, he's hitting 200, but it's...
Oh, yeah,
I know he's done damage against us. Yeah. And I think if you execute, you know, he's obviously got big, you know, damage potential, and he's got a lot of strikeout potential too. And when you execute your pitches, you usually get the job done.
Okay. Actually, that's pretty good. That's actually, okay, let me say, I'll admit, I was a bigger John Schneider fan than I am right now. Okay. I'm not crazy about the guy. I think that there's some pretty questionable decision-making at times that I don't really blame him for the Barrios thing, because he's a younger manager and he basically has to follow the cards. He has to basically follow what the computer tells him to do. But I would have never trusted him in that. That's part of the reason why I don't like him. It's like, it's nothing personal. It's that I don't think that he's got the credentials to be able to go against something like that in the moment where he feels like it's wrong. And there's been already a couple instances this year where I've disagreed with the way that he's managed. And that's just mostly kind of fun. It's, like, I think that part of being a baseball fan is disagreeing with the manager, because you're kind of trying to play along. That's one of the things you do. You armchair GM, you armchair manage. And baseball is actually one of the easier ones to do. So I'm not crazy about Schneider. Don't think that he's the world's worst manager. Don't think that he's incompetent by any stretch of the imagination. Think that he's earned his spot. But one thing I do like is that I think he's like a fiery dude. He's a fiery guy. And so every once in a while, he'll let one of those slip. And I know that part of the job now is to never say something like that. Basically, PR wants it to be never, never, never open yourself up to any criticism, because you don't want to have this, because this is so embarrassing. It's like, this is embarrassing. This is kind of fun. There's some people that'll get mad and they'll be like, oh, John Schneider, if he wouldn't have said that, Cal wouldn't have hit a home run. Like, no, come on. What are we talking about here? Rivalries are fun, right? Rivalries are what get people going. Rivalries are why the NHL completely destroyed their playoff format for now over half of a decade. They've been like, who even cares that no one really looks at the standings and knows what's going on and has to basically look at it for 15 minutes and be like, okay, right. And then this to 2 plays 3, and then you play 7 plays who, and 8 plays. Okay, right. This is the way that this works. Okay, who cares about that? They just want rivalries. They want rivalries. They want rivalries, because those move the needle. And now I got to say, so by the way, this was I didn't even mention it because some of you didn't hear it. And nobody heard it because he only said to Ryan Divish. After hitting said home run, Cal went on to go to say to Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times, quote, I know a lot of guys have beef with him around this league, so his comments aren't surprising. I don't have much to say. If I don't have something nice to say, I don't say it at all. If you don't want it to come back on you, end quote. I always think that's really funny when guys try to take the high road, but really they're already on the low road. They're like cruising down the low road. They're like, I would never take the low road as they're doing 100 miles per hour on it. Clipping different bystanders. I don't like the idea. I don't really love it when guys do the whole, like, I know a lot of guys have beef with them around the league thing. Does anybody like that kind of behavior? Do you like it when you're dealing with someone and then they have that anonymous, oh, well, you know, other people don't like them too, or other people don't like you either, or other people actually have a problem with you too. And you're like, well, say who has a problem and I'll try to figure this out. And so I get it, but I like this now. There's juice between the Mariners and the Jays. And it's funny, I was thinking about it. Now the Mariners have supplanted the Rangers as the AL West team that is the rivals with the Toronto Blue Jays. We've already got the thing where Toronto goes to Seattle and everybody in Seattle hates the Blue Jays fans. I was there last year. Again, I actually wasn't there for the Blue Jays game. People thought I went there. I was like, no, I'm here for punk rock concerts. But I was at the bar for Teo's home run where he walked off the Blue Jays, and the Mariners fans in that bar were loud, real happy. And people were, that's a pretty welcoming American city. That's a very much like you don't, it's an American city. When you're there, you don't feel like, oh man, I definitely left Canada. Like I 100% left Canada. It's like, no, it's got a very Canadian, a lot of similar feels. In that sports bar that night, there was very much like, yeah, screw Canada, screw the Blue Jays, screw their fans coming on down here. They took our seats. They took our seats. There's real hate now. There's that. There's the playoff series. The embarrassing moment for the Blue Jays where it basically broke the brains of Shapiro and Atkins, where they made a bunch of bad trades. Now we've got heat between their catcher and our manager. I like it. I like where this is going, and I'm all for it. We got the Mariners trying to sell Blue Jays merch in their team store during Blue Jays in Seattle because they're trying to capitalize on the fans. I didn't know this, but you get all the money from the merch you sell in your stadium. That's why those places are extra aggressive about that. So it's like you sell it in your stadium, you get the money. That's why they tried to do that move. But yeah, there's just enough history here now. They really do feel linked. And it's funny too, because they're both kind of parallels of each other. One out east, one out west, where, you know, they're the two franchises that had the long playoff droughts. They basically couldn't make it until baseball was like, everybody gets in. There's 1 million wild cards. You're both in. Don't worry about it. Although Jays did win their division to get in 2015. Neither of them wins. They're kind of perennial losers. They're always like, we can't quite get over the hump teams. They're sort of mirror images of each other. It makes sense that they're rivals. Anyway, rivalries. Corey Schneider, 13 years in the NHL, former NHL All-Star. What's up, brother? How are we doing? Great to have you.
Very good, man. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. So you think that the, speaking of rivalries, that's what I was talking about today. You think that the NHL's gambit here with the playoff structure is working? Like up here in Canada, we hate the new playoff format. We've hated it for years. We feel like it's unfair, but everybody just calls Leaf fans crybabies because they always have to play either Florida or Boston or Tampa in the first round, which isn't great. But how's it playing out south of the border? Cause like you're working on NHL Network now and it's a tight race, but with some bad teams. Is this working out as planned? Do you guys care about this more? Like, what's your perspective on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you ask the players, you know, at least when I played, I grew up with the 1-8 system in the conference. You know, you play the one, plays the 8 seed. And that's what I came up with. And I was with the PA in 2012-13 when they decided to change the format. And I remember players were, you know, lukewarm at best at the time. You know, they kind of liked what they had. They didn't see a real reason to change it. But the league was pretty adamant about going to two divisions in each conference and getting those rivalries back in. But it's not quite the same as it was back then. You know, it's not like the Smythe division and the, you know, those old rivalries you had where you had fewer teams, you ran into each other more often. It's like, yeah, we haven't had a Rangers Islanders series in 30 years. You know, it's like we had one Rangers Devils, at least in the US, is what I can think of. You know, for you guys up north, I know in the COVID year, Toronto Montreal played, but it doesn't seem like, yeah, they're creating new rivalries, but like Florida Toronto is not really a rivalry, you know? So I understand the sentiment, the idea behind it, but I personally think like if you have a year where you're loaded in one division, it's a huge punishment. It's a huge detriment to those teams. You could have the third and fourth best teams in the league playing each other like we did last year with the Rangers and Devils. So I understand the idea of like you need to beat everybody to go all the way, but I do think it devalues the regular season a little bit. Like you have a great regular season, you should be rewarded with an easier path, an easier matchup theoretically in the first round, and the easiest path to the finals. That's the whole point of getting all the points and being the President's Trophy winner. And I think this system devalues that a little bit if you have a strong division.
Yeah, this is the thing that drives me nuts is, we're obviously the biggest market in Canada here. And, you know, it's a driving force for the vast majority of the content. There's more Leaf fans than any other fan base. And, like, nobody cares about how many points they have. Like, not a single soul cares about where the Leafs are during these regular season games. People are watching right now to see if Auston Matthews hit 70. And that's pretty much it. Like, they're right behind Florida in the standings, and people are going, yeah, whatever, home ice, who cares? I'm like, damn, that sucks. You don't really want to have that.
Yeah, right.
Whereas if you were actually competing for being, you know, a higher seed so that you could get one of these, like, more friendly matchups with what's at the bottom, people would be scrapping and clawing, and we'd be talking about this every day. Like, man, wouldn't you rather play New York, or wouldn't you rather play the Capitals, who Toronto just absolutely body bags every time they play?
Right.
It was like, I think I was looking at this today, it's like the Islanders sitting in third behind Carolina in the Metro have 20 fewer points, like 20 fewer points, and those two are going to line up. And so I understand the attempt at rivalries. We all grew up really loving them. Like, that was the way that hockey was sold to me when I first became a fan. It was, hey, Leafs versus Montreal, that means something. And then when I was in junior high, it was Leafs versus Senators, Battle of Ontario, this really means something.
Yeah.
But I think that those things can't really be manufactured, and the NHL, for whatever reason, hasn't really figured that out.
No, I agree. I mean, some of it's got to become natural. Just the rivalries, you know, over time, just develop. And, you know, when I was in Vancouver, I mean, it's tough because you're right. I think when you get locked into that 2-3 matchup in a division and you know what's going to happen for weeks, it sort of takes some of the luster out of it. You're like, all right, let's just get to it and let's get going. The rest of the regular season sort of doesn't really matter. And I do agree that it gets rid of some of the interest. And again, you guys could run to Florida 3 years in a row and have a great series. I still don't feel like Toronto's going to hate Florida, you know, the way you would hate Montreal or the way you would hate Ottawa. So I agree. I think it is definitely the league pushing, especially those southern teams, like the Sun Belt teams that they want to, you know, promote and become more popular nationally. The Floridas, the Nashvilles, the Dallases, which they've done a great job of. But again, I don't think you're going to hate those cities and fan bases the way you do traditional hockey markets. But again, you know, sometimes when you look at the matchups anyways, if you went to a 1-8, they're not that different. And, you know, it's kind of like in the West, it's all cyclical. Like in the West this year, you could get the first seed and end up with Vegas in the first round, you know, which would stink, you know. So it is a bit of a slippery slope. I know, when we went to the finals in 2011 in Vancouver, our prize for winning the President's Trophy was getting the defending Stanley Cup champion Blackhawks as the 8th seed. Mm-hmm. Like, that wasn't very fun.
No.
So, you know, again, there are years where, yeah, it looks worse than others, but I do agree with you overall. I think more fairness and balance and reseeding as you go forward, I think, again, you should be rewarded for being a higher seed and not, you know, punished by playing a really good team. So the league doesn't seem to have much of an appetite. I know some of the owners are making some noise about potentially changing going back, but I agree with you. I think it's kind of run its course, and it hasn't really had the intended, response or results, I would say, that they wanted when they went to this playoff format.
So that's just it to me. If I was sitting across from Bettman or the decision makers here, I'd be like, okay, so what was your big reward from all this? And they're like, what was your big payoff? Because I don't feel as though any of this has materialized into something that's like, wow, now we have this. So, okay.
Right.
You already wanted parity in this league. It's why we have the salary cap, why we have, a strong cap. Okay, cool. There's parity. So now you've devalued the regular season to a point where the last month and a half is like us, what, caring about whether Washington or the Islanders get in? Like, that's
right.
That can't be it.
Yeah.
All right. So,
fight.
Yeah. So what next? Like, what is this? It just feels stubborn at this point, and that's what pisses me off is, don't just do something because you're afraid to go back to the old way. Like, that's the only thing. Yeah, you just said it. The players don't like it. The fans don't like it. It's kind of hard to digest and understand just looking at the standings quickly, which is what it's supposed to be, is like you look at the standings quick and you're like, oh, there's the 8 seed. They're out. They're in. Or even in the NBA where they got the play-ins, it's like, okay, that's easy to understand. Got it. Move forward. None of this is working. I think it's time to change it up. I think it's time to make a switch. And you're right. And that's the other thing, too, is, you know, you mentioned the President's Trophy season. Yeah, you guys played the Blackhawks in round one. That's the thing. The first round of the NHL playoffs, the Stanley Cup playoffs, are bulletproof anyways. It doesn't matter who you play because it's the best. Yeah, like no fan isn't tuning into that. It's the one time where even the most diehard basketball fans are like, we're not going to watch the one seed just beat the brakes off of the eight seed. Yeah. We want to see the intense playoff matchups that are in the first round. It's actually too good because then by the time we get to the most meaningful rounds, everybody's hurt. It's like, okay.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah,
so turns out of gas.
Yeah, I'm off it. I'm off it. Okay, so I want to talk to you about a bunch of stuff today, but I want to start with this. So speaking of your career, like in terms of playoffs, the first time you come in is like as a backup, like during a series where you're a younger guy and you have to join a playoff series and you're just kind of thrown into the fire. And Joe Woll had to do that last year, but he was like the series was over. He entered a game where they were about to go down 3-0 against Florida. And so there wasn't really like a ton of pressure of, hey, we're trying to get back into the series. It looks like that's what's going to happen to him again this season, which is he's going to enter the postseason as the backup. And I'm curious how you think that, you know, that impacted you, how you felt like you stayed prepared for something like that. Because, man, that is just about as high as intense as it gets is you going into these series and all of a sudden you're thrown in and it's like, hey, man, go out there and save us.
Yeah, it can be tough. I mean, it's good that he has the experience from last year, so at least he sort of knows what he's walking into. You know, when I was a rookie, we made that run to the finals. I came in a few games. I started one in Chicago, but I came in a few. And it's intense. Like, you don't know the intensity of the playoffs until you're in there. And watching it's one thing. Like, if you're on the bench, you feel it, so you're in it. But until you get out there and feel the pace and the flow and the intensity, it's a different animal. So, it's tricky anytime as a backup goalie, but especially in the playoffs because, you know, every shot matters. One shot could determine the entire series. So I think you really have to prepare and focus as if you're going to play. You know, I would do that. Not so much in the regular season when you're backup. You kind of – you do your thing, but you don't put the amount of energy into it as if you were starting. But in the playoffs, you know, if I was backing up, I was doing my exact same routine and preparing as if I was starting because I had to be ready. You know, I couldn't ease into the game. I couldn't see a few shots and get warm. Like, you got to be ready to go right away. So it's definitely an adrenaline rush. You have to control your emotions. You have to control your energy. You can be overly excited and jittery. But I think as a goalie, that's all those skills and tools you learn throughout the year in your career is how to harness that and just go in there and be calm, be under control, understand what you need to do, but also raise your game and raise your awareness and your level of play. So obviously, like I said, Joe showed he could do it last year, but, you know, year to year, things can be funny. It's funny how things can change, but, you know, especially in Toronto, I think he seems to have done a good job in terms of being able to control his emotions and come into games or series and play well. So that's going to be his goal.
So when you go in that first game against the Blackhawks, and you guys were getting pumped that game, right? I think I was looking it up, you were down 6-1. So there's a little bit
I think it was game 4 or 5, yeah.
Yeah, so there's like a little bit of pressure off. But are you sitting there when it's like goal 4, goal 5, and you're like, oh, man, please don't just make a save. Like, do you want to go in that moment? Or are you like, please don't do this to me. Like, please don't put me in this.
Like you said, to your point, I mean, it's a little bit – the pressure's off a bit because the game's probably out of hand. So maybe that's a better scenario than being like up 2-1 in the third and your guy gets hurt. And then you're like, oh, boy, now I got to go in.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess it might be a softer landing to do that. But your heart's still pounding. You know, you got to go in. You're cold, especially like, I think it went in the third period. Or the second period. So, like, you know, you've been sitting there for almost an hour and a half. So, like, you're not really warm. So there are some nerves and butterflies and just sort of you're like, oh, boy, here we go. But, again, I think that's why as a backup especially, you put in extra work. You practice as if you're playing. You stay out longer. You're on the ice for an hour probably that morning. So, like, that's where you get your work in and that's where you get your preparation in so that when you jump into the game, it doesn't feel like it's a foreign element. It feels like, all right, I've been doing this. You know, I just have to ramp it up here a little bit. So, it's not the best thing, let me tell you. You know, you do get a little nervous, but you also get excited because you get to go in and play in the playoffs. And I think that's the best time. I don't care who you are. Like, any competitor will tell you that the playoffs is the best kind of hockey ever. So I think you do get excited for it as well.
Yeah, it's just funny because my mind, if I'm you, is all I'm thinking of is how the second you get in the net, the broadcast is, anybody who's watched hockey knows this, the broadcast is just focused on you. And so then it's like, here's Corey Schneider. And they're like, it's like this guy, I don't know. All of a sudden it's a referendum on you and it's national. And it's just like, people are talking about you. So you're taking your sip of water. You're, you know, trying to warm up in between the pipes and you just know the camera is dead focused on you. And everyone's like, all right, let's see what you got, buddy. Like, we don't know you, but let's see what's going on here. Hey, can you save the series? So What about the politics of it too? Because this is what really fascinates me with the Leafs goaltending right now, is that they've got a guy in Samsonov who basically everybody had written off for this season because he was really struggling. Wool was playing great. He gets hurt. Samsonov plays great. And then the two of them are basically in a competition for who's going to be starting in net come playoff time. You had a bit of a, like your career is funny because you were with Luongo and then Brodeur. So it was like, okay, pecking order here is fairly clear. The politics probably aren't that difficult. But yeah, you mentioned it. You got to start in one of those games in Vancouver. And do you feel like, I'm sure Luongo was supportive of you personally, but how does that add a layer of difficulty to this? Like what is the politics side of this with your fellow netminder? Or I don't want to say the guilt of this, but, you know, you want the net, but you know it might come at their expense and you need to be able to try to capitalize on your opportunity. Like, is it difficult to compartmentalize that when you've worked so closely with the other person and they're really the only person that understands what you go through?
I think, you know, there's a couple, I guess, different ways to answer that question, but I think, you know, it depends. I think the relationship you have with your goalie partner is unique. Everybody's unique. You have some guys you get along great with. You have other guys who, you know, you work with. And there's a difference. You respect, but you're just your coworkers. So with me and Roberto, I think, like you said, it was a definite hierarchy. Like, he was the guy, and there was no question about that. So I think that made it a little bit easier. But to Roberto's credit, he handled it, you know, about as well as any superstar Hall of Fame goalie probably could have. You know, I don't know if, and this is no dig at him, but, like, I don't know if Marty would have felt the same way, because Marty was just in a different aura and different mindset. Yeah. Like, he always felt he could do it, and so did Roberto. But, you know, Marty, I think, you know, what made him so great was that he just was like, no, I'm playing every game, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and Roberto, you know, it wasn't easy for him. You know, Elaine Vigneault sat us down in the hotel in Chicago before game six, the two of us, and we're just like, hey, you know, here's what's happening. We're going to play Schneid. Like, don't tell anybody, but Roberto, you know, and you could tell it hit him hard. Like, he mm-hmm. wasn't expecting it. I think he was a little disappointed, but because he's such a fantastic person and teammate, he was very supportive of me no matter what he felt on the inside. So, that's the first part of it, is whatever your relationship is with your guy and what kind of person he is. The second is, I think, and I'm kind of liking it now, but back then it was, like I said, it was much more of a 1-2 situation. You had your guy who played 60-70, and you had your backup. And I think almost to a fault back then, coaches just relied on their number one because it was the safe choice. You know, if they had to make a decision, I'm just going to go with the guy who got me here. Maybe he wasn't playing great. Maybe the other guy was playing better, was better. But I think they had that comfort and knowledge that, you know, for job security, maybe it's like, hey, I threw out my number one. Mm-hmm. He lost. It's not my fault. What do you want me to do? I think nowadays you're seeing a lot more of 1-1A situations, 1A, 1B, where the coaches aren't afraid to go with the backup and run with them until they falter. If you look at every team trying to get in the East, they're all using their number twos. You know, Varlamov, Lindgren, Ersson, Nedeljkovic in Pittsburgh, Alex Lyon. Like, none of these guys were the opening night starters or the number ones per se, but the coaches are saying, hey, this guy's hot. I'm going to ride him. You know, feelings and contracts be damned to the other guys. So I think there's been a mindset shift, which is good. But to your point, it's tough because, you know, you go with the hot guy until he falters, and then the other guy goes in. You know, so you can't really afford to let a guy work through things or have a bad game these days. It seems pretty knee-jerk to put the other guy right in. So whether that's the right call or not, I don't know. But I think in Toronto, it sounds like they're going to ride Samsonov into the playoffs, but I guarantee if game one he falters, they're going to write back to Joe Wall. So
that's what I mean.
Both guys definitely have to be ready. I feel like rarely do you win cups now, like Vasilevsky, where you go wire to wire. You need both guys to come in and win games three at some point. So I think there's much more of a meritocracy involved with goaltending rather than you're the number one, you're going to play, and I'm going to ride or die with you because that's the safest choice I can make.
Well, dude, yeah, to your point is forever it was always, hey, what do you want in a backup goalie? Is a guy who will, you know, shut up about it. You know, like, is
right.
A guy who is just going to be
good
there.
Guy, and, good locker room guy.
Yeah, exactly.
All that stuff. Yeah.
That was like a real trait is you'd get someone and be
absolutely.
Like, hey.
Guys had long careers doing that.
Yeah, that's what he's like. Is he any good? No, but man, he's great in the room. No. That's where we leave him.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Yeah, that's what he's good. He's coming in some back-to-backs and a few times a year and not going to make any noise and not going to put any pressure on the main guy, and this is his job. Like, good for him. Like, awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, awesome. So do you like that Vigneault handled it that way, where both you guys were in the room at the same time? Because I would have been sitting there going like, dude, why are you doing this in front of me? Like, this is brutal.
It was a little, you know, I'd rather know than not know. Or, you know, there's been coaches who haven't told me until like the night before or the day of, you know, okay, you're playing. So they like to keep it this big guessing game even amongst the goalies. So I didn't mind that part that he told us. the saddest. Both we like literally landed in Chicago, got to the hotel. He's like, you know, Roberto Schneider, come with me. And we're like, oh boy. So it is a little nerve wracking, at least as a rookie. You know, it was my first full year, and I'm sitting next to Roberto Luongo,
yeah,
being told that he's not going to play, and I am. So, again, thankfully, Roberto and I had that kind of relationship where I didn't like I wasn't worried that he was mad at me, but it was a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry that he's like mad at you, but to me, the reason why I wouldn't like that move is if I'm him, I want to be able to say my piece, my full piece. And I feel like you couldn't do that in a room with the person beside you when you're trying to be a good guy as well, right? Like, you have to balance those two things. So if it's you and you're just a kid sitting beside Roberto Luongo and you're like, yeah, no, it's just the Vancouver Canucks Stanley Cup playoff chances. It's no big deal. Nobody really cares. It's fine. You're kind of just sweating it, being like, I guess so.
Yes, sir. Okay, yeah. Sir. Just kind of keeping your head down and being like, sorry, Lou.
You know? I was going to say, could you say
you're almost apologizing to him.
Yeah, that's
I didn't say much. I just sort of said, okay. I just sort of shook my head. I was like, okay, yeah, thanks. Uh-huh. You sounds great.
Yeah.
And then I kind of looked at Roberto. We talked on the way out because we had to walk out together too.
Yeah.
He was super supportive, but I was like, hey, man, he's like, you'll be, you know, like, I'll, you know, we'll win this, and you'll be the guy going forward. But like, you know, whatever. So, but what can you say to him? Like, he knows.
Yeah.
He knows. It's like, I'm going to give him any help or any support. Like, he's been there before.
Yeah. You know, it's fine. I've always thought, like, recently anyway, especially now that it's the 1A, 1B. And they could never do it because being a goalie is so demanding and difficult from a psychology standpoint, like a mental standpoint in the first place. But if they really wanted to do something great when it comes to the content, have you seen the F1 show?
Drive to Survive.
Yeah. So
Drive to Survive. Yeah.
No, but it's a fascinating thing because you're teammates with the person, right? And you drive the same car. You're driving the exact same car. It's all the same specs.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that makes him your number one rival. And so it's a similar thing with the goaltenders now where it's like, okay, cool. This is the only person that knows your experience. You could be friends or you could be colleagues, like you said. But ultimately, you are driving the same car, right? Like, it's the same team in front of you. And yes, maybe some circumstances change. Maybe you're in the second half of a back-to-back or whatever. But now, the way it is like you said, both guys are usually vying for time. Nobody's playing, like... Go look at Ed Belfour's old game logs or seasons. It's hilarious. It's like he's played the whole year. It's just every game.
I looked at Marty's the other day. It was like 10 years of 78 games or something stupid.
Yeah. I had McElhaney on last year before he took the Leafs job, and he was like, yeah, backing up Vasilevsky was great, but also kind of tough because he's like, I'm not coming out in any game. Like, it's game 82 of the regular season, and you're locked into a spot, and he's like, I need this start, man. Sorry. Stay on the bench. There's very few guys that are like that. But for the rest of the groups, I think that trying to balance that relationship, the politics of it, the feelings of, well, damn, they weren't good tonight and I'm bearing the brunt of this. Like, I think it's got to be one of the most fascinating in terms of if you were going to document anything in hockey right now, that's what I would choose. That's the series I would pitch.
Yeah, you know, the NFL's been doing these quarterback shows. Yeah. I think they're a receiver show. They could do like a goalie show for Netflix.
That's what I'm saying. Goaltender.
Maybe I'll be a part of that. Yeah, it is. It's a unique position. It's very rare. You know, the only ones I can sort of equate it to are sort of like quarterback or pitcher in baseball. You're on an island a bit, you know, and you have to process a lot of information. And, you know, you're the goat or the hero. There's no real in between. So, when it comes to that, you know, I was a competitor. Like, I wanted to play. Like, you're not going to play unless you have that mindset that I'm going to take the net from somebody. But at the end of the day, I always realized, like, I'm playing for the team. I'm not playing for myself necessarily. So we're both trying to achieve the same thing. We're both trying to win games for our team to make the playoffs and win the Stanley Cup. And at some point, it's like, all right, if it's not me, then him, at least we're winning. You know, it's you try to put that aside and just say, hey, you know, what's the end goal here? What are we trying to do? And yes, we're competing against each other, but that competition, I think, raises the level of the team, because if your goalie's playing well, you know, you can beat anybody. So I always wanted it to be me. I always pushed myself to be my best. So that way I was the guy. I hated watching games because you have no control. I got way more nervous watching games from the bench than I did playing, because at least when you're playing, you have some control. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that OCD is, you know, of goaltending is being in control and knowing that you can do it and not trusting other people to do it. It's just inherent. But I've had mostly great goalie partners, but at some points, some guys get selfish, or it's about them, or they pout if they're not playing well, or they don't get the start. And it's like, I get that competitive part of it. Once the game starts, it's like, hey, all 20 guys who are dressed tonight, we're all trying to win the game for this team. So let's just put everything aside and do whatever we have to do that, whether that's supporting your starting goalie, whether that's coming in for him, whether that's, you know, picking up your teammates and being active and working hard for them in practice so that they get better. You sort of have to balance all that, like you said, but it is a unique relationship. It's very, you know, again, there's only one net. So, you know, it's like, you know, show me a team with two goalies, I'll show you a team with none, because it's hard to pick between the two, or you can't decide. And all of a sudden it's paralysis by analysis, and you gotta figure it out. But that's the hard part for head coaches. And I think they put a lot more in the last 5-10 years into the goaltending division just to sort through all this and figure out who the best guy to play is.
Yeah, that's my only, I wouldn't say that my only issue with it, but my overarching issue with the way that it goes is what you just said, though. It's okay, if Samsonov has a bad game, then Wohl might be in game two. And I would just be thinking, if I'm a goalie or anybody in any position, right? Like, job security is a bit of a myth in all industries, but the idea of having such a short leash, right? Because it's always like, okay, you let that goal in, forget about it. But how could you forget about it when it's like, oh, you let in one bad goal, then you lost your job potentially, and you're a free agent next year. Like, now you're thinking about whether or not you're going to be able to secure the bag for your family, whether or not you're going to have the same opportunity going into the next season, whether people view you as a choker or someone that can get it done in the postseason. Like, it's just such a heavy thing to have in one game. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, we talk about all the time, if you're a forward or a winger, you can make 7-8 mistakes in a game, and, you know, maybe one ends up in your net. You're a defenseman, you can make 3 or 4. You're a goalie, you make one mistake, that's the game. And I think that's the fine line and the precision you have to have. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's why head coaches rely more on the goaltending department. Because, again, coaches, that's part of your job as a head coach, is to have a feel and a pulse of the team. And both goalies, you know, it's kind of the cliche over the years, at least when I played, the head coach is like, just stop the puck. I don't care about goalies. Yeah. You guys do you.
Yeah.
Until he has to decide who plays. And it's like, if you don't know how your goalie looks, how he's moving, how he's thinking, you can tell your guy's a wreck. It's like, I can't play this guy. I got to go with the other guy, you know? So, like, that's part of your job, is to understand as the head coach which goalie seems to be feeling it or has the confidence of the group and, you know, has the confidence of the team. Maybe not who's the higher paid guy or the guy who's played better during the year. So that's where head coaches have to earn their money, is understanding that and making the right decision for the team. Because like you said, a lot goes into it. And if you have a guy who's like breaking down mentally, then you can't afford to play him.
Oof. Yeah, no, I don't. This is making me nervous talking about this, Scott. No, and I'm just like, it's giving me anxiety just even having this conversation, because I'm like, I really do have a theory watching these games right now where they, so it looks like they're going to play Samsonov, right? But obviously the mental stuff got to him this year. And I do feel like they keep trying to trot Wohl out and go, man, steal it. Just do something. Give us any kind of excuse so that we don't have to do this back and forth, because I think that they're eventually going to give him the job. But that undercurrent that I'm talking about is what I think ultimately could be the undoing of a guy like Samsonov. So I don't know. I don't know if they've handled it properly. By the way, the reason why, and I'll give you a, you know, co-producer credit on my pitch to Netflix of goaltender, but it'll never work because the second one of you guys gives like a half interesting quote that goes, you know, the second you show some dejected body language, the coaches immediately across the league are like, you can never have this guy in the room.
Exactly. About the team.
You can't have one human moment. You have one human moment, and it's like, that's too bad. That's too bad. I guess we'll never hear from him again. Enjoy the AHL, buddy. I hope you enjoy the game.
Mental midget. If you show any sort of like emotion or vulnerability, you're a mental midget. Yes. I can't hire you.
100%. Yeah. Enjoy Russia, where it's all about being selfish anyway. So you'll love it over there.
It's like, exactly.
Last thing. Two more things. One is that being in the Canadian markets and being a goaltender and like the stuff that we're talking about here, where it's just, you know, I spend days and days and days and have guests on like you to talk about the mental side and what these goalies are going through and this micro analysis of goalies. Whereas like, you know, the Southern markets or the other ones, most people don't even know who their like two goalies are. They can't name both of them.
Yeah.
How much does that bleed in? Like, I know that, I'm sure you did a decent enough job at keeping it out, but how much of that is a real, a real part of the job?
I mean, it's very real. And, you know, having played in both Vancouver and New Jersey, you know, I got to feel both sides of that. And I would always say I was really lucky and fortunate to start my career in a Canadian market, even Manitoba and Winnipeg, where I started. It was you know, pretty intense there as well. So I think it forges you a little bit. I think it gives you that exposure to see what it's like at the highest level in terms of scrutiny and attention. And I think that's a good thing to learn under, because then when you get to the you know, the big spotlight, you're more comfortable. So, you know, I think it just depends on the guy. Some guys are like, leave me alone. I just want to go play hockey. I don't want to deal with anything else. And that's how they thrive. Some guys, it's like, I need the juice. I need the attention. I need the, you know, the pressure, because I play better under that. So, you know, I always said there was a difference between, you know, going to a Hockey Night in Canada game in Van against Toronto on a Saturday night. The city's buzzing. You know, people are wearing jerseys. It's like you feel that energy and that juice, and it feeds into the game. And then, you know, no disrespect, but, you know, when I got to Jersey, it's like, all right, you're playing Arizona on a Tuesday night in the building, you know, two-thirds full. And you got to create a lot of your own energy. So that was an adjustment for me. And, you know, I think, again, some guys thrive off of it. Some guys need that. I like both, to be honest. It was nice to be in New Jersey where they had a, you know, a hardcore base of fans. But, you know, you're in New York City. You're the New York metro area. So there's a lot going on. So you're not always the focus. You're not constantly being asked questions every day about things that you're like, what are we talking about here? You know? But then, you know, like I said, in Vancouver, it has a different feel to it. There's just that buzz and that energy that you don't get many other places. And yeah, you deal with the media and, you know, the stuff with me and Luongo, and the controversy was always funny because we always laughed it off because we got along great and we just wanted to play well and win a Stanley Cup. So, you know, it can become a distraction if you let it. And I think when you're younger, you know, you're not quite as, you don't have the perspective to sort of say, okay, hey, look, I can block this out, or I can, you know, move past this. You know, I don't need to focus on this as much. When you get older, you're sort of like, all right, I got kids, I got a family, like that's more important to me. I don't have time to deal with like the media stuff. Mm-hmm. But you know, I was also say, like, when I came into Vancouver, like Twitter and social media were kind of just getting going. So they were a thing, but it's not like it is today. Like, it's unavoidable today. It feels like with the news cycle and social media, it's like you can't avoid, if you're in Canada, you know, I think partaking or at least checking out to see what's going on. So it's a little bit different dynamic. But again, you know, I think it depends on the player, and you want to find guys who can thrive. Like, I'm a guy from Boston. I heard you talking about the Jays earlier. Like, not every baseball player could play in Boston because it's a tough media market and there's a lot of scrutiny, and some guys just didn't pan out. And I think as a Canadian market, you got to find the guys who want to be there and can enjoy it and thrive in those situations, because it is a different animal.
That's part of the fun, though, I think, of being a fan of these teams, is that you get to see those kind of players. And when the guys do come here and they get it, like right now, this season, people have like really fallen in love with Max Domi here because like his dad was a Leaf.
Right.
He grew up in the Leafs dressing room. He completely understands it, where it's like, you know, Michael Bunting comes to town and they're playing the Pittsburgh Penguins, and he's like, I'm going to try to fight this guy. And you're like, awesome. You know, that's so great that you're trying to do that. Yeah. He's totally tapped in, sense of the moment, all this stuff. Fans love it, adore it. There's been other guys who haven't, and, you know, they've left and whatever. It's all credit to them. It's not for everybody. But I think that payoff is that the people do love you that way, and you do get that jolt. You do get that energy. And from the media standpoint and the fan scrutiny standpoint, I think what you said there about your relationship to Luongo is like, that's applicable to everything. Is you can always deal with outside noise, no matter what it is, as long as the people around you, your direct relationships in the working environment, are strong ones, and you have good communication skills, and you do have trust of the people, like your relationships. That's what makes it. The social media stuff, though, that mentioned, like, that's the fascinating stuff to me now, where it's like, you ever just sitting there, I was asking this question as though it's, the answer is obvious because you're a human, and you just find yourself like looking at your phone, scrolling, and you're like, I didn't even want to do this. Like, I'm just now looking. You know, like, I just opened it up out of pure addiction.
Right.
I can't imagine what that would be like as a player, when you can open up your Twitter and Instagram and you just have access to your highlights, nonstop commentary on you, you know, like... It must be impossible to not just be scrolling through that. And the people who are like, just put your phone away, I'm like, you just put your phone away. Like, tell me how that goes.
Yeah.
Like, that's impossible to do.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. Like, I don't know how guys do that, but I feel like that's got to be just that's got to be a nightmare for so many guys now. That just how much is there?
Yeah, it's impossible to avoid, I think. And I guess some guys are better than others, and if you're good enough, you don't really listen to the noise. But and you have people texting you, got your buddies like, hey, did you see this thing about you? Or like, oh my god, like this,
that's
so-and-so saying this.
Why?
And it's like, so even if you avoid it, it's like people are still going to tell you about it, whether you want to or not. Or if you walk around town, it's a narrative that runs through the city. And I mean, again, it's a challenge for today's generation in general. And you know, it's just tough because, you know, people are always like, oh, well, you signed up for it. It's like, kind of, you know, I played hockey. It was a sport. I'm really good at it.
Yeah.
I know I make a lot of money doing it, generally speaking, but like, I didn't sign up to be picked apart, like personally, or my family to be attacked or things like that. Like, there are lines that people cross. And it's like, well, you're a public figure. You got to handle it. And you do, for the most part. Most guys just, you know, can compartmentalize, but it can affect guys, especially nowadays where everyone online is just, you know, they all have an opinion and they don't care if you read it or not, or what it means to you or your family. And it's very detached and desensitized in terms of what goes on. Cause like you said, they are people, and you know, it's, you know, I'm not trying to bang the drum for, you know, that kind of sensitivity, but it's real. And
no, it is.
I think some people lose that when you're on a keyboard or a phone. You don't really think about the impact of what it could mean to anybody else.
No. The only thing is again, if you have relationships in the real world and you're able to step out of it, I feel like you're able to compartmentalize it easier because you're like, oh, wait, that's not real.
Yeah.
And then the people who are like
exactly.
constantly on it and, you know, decide to be too involved in it, then it becomes like this overwhelming reality where, you know, that's like, that's all they know. That's their communities. That's their
right.
feedback. That's it. And it's like, no, you got to step outside of it. Do you remember, like, you know, what was the worst thing you remember somebody said about you? Like the Canadian critique where you're like, oh man, are you serious? Like,
you know what? Fortunately for me, it wasn't too bad. I know people, like I said, I have social media, but like my Instagram's private. I never really got on Twitter.
Smart.
So I've tried, like, that's part of it too. And maybe I'm just of that generation where, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s where, you know, we didn't need to be online all the time. So like, I do have it for a reason, but it's not to promote myself or put myself out there. And I think sometimes when you don't put yourself out there, you don't expose yourself to some of these commentary. So and it's funny too, like when you meet people in person, I've never, almost never, nope. I maybe one or two people in my life have ever said anything negative to me as a person.
Yeah.
So it's funny how that works too, where everyone's a keyboard warrior and then they meet you and it's like, hey, can I get a picture and an autograph? So you kind of learn that too. Fans are fans. I get that. It's an emotional experience. Like that's part of the great thing about it is they get so emotional and they get worked up and that's what makes fans great, but then it can go the other way as well. You know, there have been more incidences where, you know, either my wife was brought into something or somebody said something about her or, you know, like that bothers me more because, like, I understand I'm playing, I can handle critique and, like, that's part of the job. But the people in your life, they don't sign up for that. Like, they're there to support you. So if people come after them, then that's a different issue. So that's probably more where I've had issues than myself personally.
Yeah, of course. But, yeah, that's just, like, again, that's the anonymous Twitter bots. Like, yeah, it's hard to believe.
Right.
That, yeah, so those ones you're like, yeah, whatever, this is nothing. But it's so true, man. It's been the same thing. Like, it's media, it's way smaller degrees. But sometimes you'll run into people and they'll be like, oh, like the show. And then one of their friends will be like, he hates you. And you'll start laughing. And then immediately they start to blubber going like, oh, no, I just, you know, this is the thing. And I'm I bet you if I search your tweets, it's going to be really embarrassing what I end up reading back to you, huh? And it's like, no, there's something about that disconnect on the screen where people lose their minds. And then you meet them in person. It's like 99% of the time they're like totally normal. And they're like, oh, yeah, sorry, I was heated up in a moment. And I just disagreed and I got mad. Like,
for sure.
Yeah, sure.
I feel like people forget, too, that they leave digital footprints. Like, you know, I can go back and look at the things you've said in life, you know?
I know.
Job or for whatever, it's like, you know, this all stays on the internet forever, right, guys?
Yeah, no, we started learning that when like athletes were getting drafted and it was like, and here's this tweet from
back in high school.
I was like thank God I never had it in high school. I never would have been
here.
I'd be digging ditches somewhere. Like I'd have to go somewhere where it was this complete anonymity into the wilderness, like no one ever heard from me again, abandon my family and friends, and that's it. Hey Corey, thanks for doing this today, man. I really appreciate it. Great chat, and good luck with everything in media, man.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Corey Schneider, 13 seasons of the NHL, former NHL All-Star. Good guy. Gonna have a good career. Let's take a quick break. Let's talk about banners and, Chris Webber later in the show today, which, I already taped it, but it was awesome. I really enjoyed getting to talk to Chris. So that's later. That's at 10 o'clock, or if you're listening on the podcast, in a few minutes.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Chris Webber in a couple minutes. A few little pieces of business to take care of here. One is, I just want to say this is the last time I'm going to talk about anything to do with the Arizona Coyotes arena. I don't talk about it much ever in general, but... Is there anything like, does everybody remember Deflategate where we're year into Deflategate and you went, are we, okay, please enough, mercy. Any type of labor negotiations between players and owners that expands beyond a few weeks? Oh, during the pandemic when baseball couldn't get its act together right away, like, that was painful. But I think, like, if I was doing the Mount Rushmore of things in my life that I have hated, like make me feel physically some way, the second I see a headline, it's anything to do with the Arizona Coyotes and their arena and their fans and their relocation and whatever the hell they're doing. And again, I'm a person who is the most sympathetic to any fan who loses their team. I grew up, my number one team outside of the Maple Leafs was the Seattle Supersonics. And they left Seattle in horrific terms. I got all the time in the world for fans of teams that lose them to relocation. But Arizona is the exception to that rule. Oh, my God. I love how, too, now the narrative is flipping from, ooh, actually, it turns out that the NHL players don't want to play in the Mickey Mouse Arena. Oh, what? You want to work your ass off and get drafted by the team that doesn't have professional facilities and that sits 5,000 people? No, I what a surprise. Quelle surprise that this didn't work out and that it isn't working out and guys aren't happy about it. Duh. Like, do you know what it takes for me to root for Utah? Like, yes, I want Utah to have a thing. Oh, this is where you forced me with it. So please, for the love of God, for the love of God, whatever this land auction is, whatever happens with this story, with all due respect, just please, just get it over with. For the love of God, please get it over with. This is when one of the most stubborn things in all of pro sports is the Arizona Coyotes and the NHL's insistence of making it work in this Arizona market when no one there has really ever wanted it. We already got what we needed out of it, which was Austin Matthews. Like, it's a success for that, for Leafs fans. But it's almost like this is, again, Simpsons monkey paw stuff. Hey, you get the greatest goal scorer in the history of your organization, but that comes at the price of the most painful story about an arena in a who cares fan base for your entire life. Your entire life, there will always be Arizona Coyotes news about the arena. Imagine, though, like, so if they win this thing, they keep the team in Arizona, they got to play multiple more seasons at that mullet arena, and so you just stay in the rebuild for, like, perpetuity? You're just bad, 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 and constant. Like, how many draft picks do these guys already have? They've been bad forever. Arizona stinks. They're an unwatchable product. So what, now their guys start asking out, and you get what? Prospect? Like, ugh, mercy. Please, please, for the love of God, rig it. Make sure that Utah gets this team, that they play an arena, that they've got some new fun, whatever. I don't care. Anything but this. Anything but more Arizona content. Anyways, end of... I don't think anybody feels any other way about this. And so that was probably the least interesting segment I've ever done because everyone's like, yeah, good. Way to take the most obvious take ever, which is please no more Arizona guys. Never forget that I, though, prayed that Connor Bedard wouldn't go there. People were like, but it could help the other market. Like, imagine Bedard was on Anaheim or Arizona right now. Like, I know Chicago is dreadful. Like, the Blackhawks are horrific. But he's in a market that matters. And they are going to hopefully turn this thing around a season from now. Like, next year, there's already a ton of pressure on that team to be good. They can't just be bad again. So, God. Anybody that cried to me about that, you were wrong. I'm sorry. You were dead wrong. Okay. We got a break. I'll do this later. I'll do banners later. I didn't see this. I'll tease it a little bit. I didn't see the... Jays put the wild card banners up. Like, when I was at the game, I didn't look up to see it. I'm going again on Friday, so I'll look when I go on Friday. But yeah, I don't even know who. I guess if you were sitting, I was sitting underneath the outfield, so I would have had to, like, legitimately crane my neck up. But yeah, I honestly don't know how I feel about it. So I'll flesh that out later on the show. But yeah, now we got to take a break. We got to talk to NBA or, well, Basketball Hall of Famer, member of the Fab Five, and author Chris Webber. That's next.
Getting
I'll probably do my NBA awards in, like, rapid fire fashion. I'll probably do my hockey ones too. Actually, today I'm gonna guess some of the player poll stuff for hockey. So it's getting pretty close to doing my ballots. I heard the morning show today talking about Matthews and whether or not he should be up for the Hart and where he is in the Hart ballot. I actually think that this is one of the more difficult seasons in recent history when it comes to, like, how you would stack the Hart voting. Because I think there's clearly five guys at the top, like, clearly. And yet the way that you stack them, I think you could kind of make a pretty compelling case for all. Like, to me, McKinnon's at the top. But like McDavid might hit 100 assists. Like, what are you supposed to do with that? Matthews could score 70 goals. You're not going to have a guy with 70 goals in the top three? Like Kucherov, I think, is something stupid like 20 points above the next teammate of his. A lot of that's on power play, but still, like, he's had a dominant season, and he's basically carried that Tampa team to be in the position they are, where they can start to get hot and feel dangerous. And then now Sidney Crosby, who, by the way, as much as I love Sid, and I deeply, deeply care about Sid, yes, he's carrying his team right now, but also his team has been the worst of them, and his stats are also the worst, and it's like, okay, yeah, but, okay. He's supposed to be above these guys? I'm like, you know, I think it's a little bit of a, yeah. Those four guys should all be ahead of Sid. As much as I love Sid, as much as I want to give him all the credit in the world for what Pittsburgh's doing, and as much as he does deserve that credit, and God damn, he's playing all the best hockey at all the right times. Yeah, he's not in this position if it's not for a lot of other teams being horrific this year. And he has the worst stats and the worst record. Like, I don't really understand the case. Other than we all love Sid. And what he's doing at his age is phenomenal. But, like, that's not what the award is supposed to be. Anyways, I'm going to do my NBA awards. Maybe I'll rapid fire them. I'll share some. But I will say this. I saw last night Jokic and the T-Wolves played, right? And everyone's like, well, this is the one matchup that's supposed to be able to kind of limit Jokic, because they can throw Rudy Gobert at him. Like, yeah, Rudy Gobert, the guy who wins Defensive Player of the Year every year, is probably going to win it again this season. Like, he's the front runner for it. Because people don't want to give it to Wembanyama because they know he's going to win every single season for the rest of his career. And so he probably won't win this year, even though I actually think that he should. Like, he, if you look at it, I think that there was a stupid stat that I saw the other day. I think it was even yesterday, where it was Wembanyama already has more 8 block games in his career than Rudy Gobert. Like, already. And Rudy Gobert is one of the most imposing physical presences that we've ever seen defending the basket. And Wembanyama has already surpassed him in terms of, like, volume of those shots, which is just insane. Like, insane. So Wembanyama going to be, basically, as long as he's not hurt, you can put him down in pen for DPOY every single season. And whenever you try to get cute about it and try to involve somebody else, it's like, okay, tell me if your life was on the line and you needed to get a stop, if you would take the other player or Wembanyama. Like, let's just shut up about this. Let's shut up about the whole where you don't like to give guys multiple awards every season in a row. And that's how I feel about the Jokic thing right now. Is Jokic is obviously the MVP. And I've seen people try to make, like, the case for others, and I kind of think it's stupid. Like, I'm sorry. There's no case to be made for anyone. The guy who is the MVP is the guy that had 41 points last night against Rudy Gobert. There is one guy that you would take with your life on the line right now on planet Earth to close a game. It is not Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, all due respect. I love Shai. Everybody loves Shai. It ain't Shai. Please, please, please. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this again? It's unanimous MVP. I understand that you start looking at it and stacking the historical precedence of having this many MVPs for Jokic and the company that he keeps, but Jokic is that good. Jokic is that good. He belongs in that category. And the minimization of him, for whatever reason, by some, is so strange. Like, I get it when it's Gilbert Arenas, but I don't get it when it's real NBA people who are putting this out here. Like, he's not the unquestionable MVP of the season. And God, just, it's him. It's the guy who had 41 last night, 41 and 11, with, I think, 7 dimes against the Timberwolves. Who are what?
NBA players with 3 MVPs. This is short.
Yeah, I know it.
LeBron James, yeah. Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Moses Malone, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Will Chamberlain, Bill Russell.
Yeah, and people are terrified to put him in that company because it feels sudden and it feels too soon, and they shouldn't. They really shouldn't. And again, this is another season where they removed Bruce Brown, didn't really add anybody, and Jamal Murray plays, what, every second game? And this guy still gets it done no matter what. Like, still, this is the thing, is I try to give Jamal Murray credit, and I do believe that he and Jokic are the best two-man combo to close a game in the NBA. Like, nothing beats them. That's why they're going to win again, is that when it gets to crunch time, it's just them. That's the only reason why I really believe in the Mavericks, is the only team that I actually think can do it and push them is the Mavs. That two-man game of Luka and and Kyrie, that could be something. And we saw it. We saw proof of concept with it. And granted, Kyrie had to hit one of the most outrageous shots I've ever seen in my entire life, but we've seen proof of concept. But I brought up how Murray is the hardest guy to evaluate ever. I did a segment on this where he's never made an all-star team. You look at his points per game, they're not overwhelming, and yet we all acknowledge that he's very clutch. He's had big playoff moments. He's killer in the two-man game. There's no doubt in my mind, because we've seen it, where Denver hasn't had him, and they haven't been able to win. Like, that's part of the Jokic story, is that Murray has been hurt in a lot of these seasons, and when we were dragging Jokic for not winning, it was in part because he didn't have Jamal Murray. So clearly, he needs to have somebody of that caliber who can play. But then when you're talking about like regular season statistics and like someone who can just elevate all others like Steve Nash did or like LeBron does, it's Jokic. He is the number one, makes all of his teammates around him better guy. And then he also can just go dummy Rudy Gobert for 41 points like without breaking a sweat. So, yeah, if you have an MVP ballot, please, for the love of God, you know, or you know somebody who has an MVP ballot, beg them not to do this crazy thing of, oh, it's Shea, or it's, you know, it's nobody else.
Luka is the other one.
It's not Luka. It's not Luka. It's not Shea. It's Jokic. It should be unanimous. And I like down ballot stuff. I like arguing between Shea and Luka, and where should Jason Tatum be? He probably deserves a little bit. Fine. That stuff's fun. That's great. But it's Jokic. Anyways, I got a chance to talk to another great big man. Probably should ask him what he thinks about Jokic, but I didn't. So spoiler alert, there's no current NBA stuff in here. I actually did think about getting to some of it and thought about asking him, you know, what was going on or how he felt about some NBA stuff. But I actually didn't think that the conversation was going there, but I really enjoyed it. Here's Chris Webber. Very, very, very excited to be joined by a guy I'm a huge fan of. It's Basketball Hall of Famer, member of the Fab Five, and now author of his memoir, By God's Grace, which you can get. It's a limited edition book. Comes complete, by the way, with a signed autograph by Chris Webber. You can go to his website, chrisweber.com, for more details. The website is nice, too. It's a very nice job. Chris Webber, thanks for doing this.
Thank you very much, and make sure that we fix all our issues so that if you're in Canada, you can get them. So looking forward to, you know, seeing the people's response. But it was a long journey and writing it. It was a fun and exciting time and a lot of great moments I wanted to celebrate and relive.
Okay, so this is... getting ready to interview you, your life has so much, right? Like, you've been famous since you were a kid, and you've also had endeavors beyond basketball, like into, you know, charity and music production, and, you know, now you're writing a book. How overwhelming was it to sit down and actually go through all of this? Because, like, I got to interview, you could interview you for hours and hours and hours. Like, how did you leave stuff out? Like, how long did this take you?
Man, Jay, thanks for asking that question, because this is one of the toughest things I've ever done. First of all, hopefully anyone, any kids, any adults, if you get a chance, you should interview your parents. Just interview your family members. If you start there, you'll have so many revelations, why you're the way you are, and find out so many things maybe people didn't want to talk about. And so I always had blinders on during the season. You know, you get talked about, you get criticized, and you got to stay focused, right? And so with those, you miss a lot of moments. You don't celebrate a lot of moments. And so I started with just a stenographer talking and wanting to see my words on paper. And then it turned into, you know, an outline and bullet points and removing chapters. And so really I tried to just tell the story of how, no matter if things were great or bad in my life, how the grace of God, which is that positive current that we all need at our worst moments, just sustained me. And that's kind of how I look back. So my father being an auto worker, my mother being a teacher, and how them raising me kind of gave me my attitude on the court, because we all are our collective experiences, not just our job. And so it, as confusing as I sound trying to explain it, that's how hard it was trying to sift through and keep, you know, and decide what stories to keep. But overall, hopefully it's, I know it's honorable. I know it's honest, and hopefully it inspires at the end of the day.
No, but first of all, the thing you said there right away is bang on about interviewing your parents and about, the loved ones in your life, the older people. Like my grandfather also wrote a book, and I'm so grateful that he did, because I got to learn so much about him. And I feel like the people in your life specifically, like, it's great that fans like me are going to be able to read this book and get a different perspective on you, right? Like, that's entertaining. You've got a very compelling life. But more so than anything, the legacy of that will be that through your own lens, through your own words, the people who love you the most will be able to understand you better than they ever could. And that is the one, I don't really love living with regret, but the one thing that I definitely learned as I got older was, man, I was so caught up in my life and whatever, you're a teenager, you're young. I wasn't Chris Webber with things going on. So it's kind of a more stay with you, but you really miss getting those opportunities with the people that are older than you, is getting their perspective and truly sitting in what it was like to have their lives. And so I do think that this is going to be great. And, you know, that's the other thing. For you specifically, so many people have told your story, right? So many people have weighed in on what it's like to be Chris Webber, what it was like, who was Chris Webber, and everything. Again, from when you were a teenager, how cathartic was it for you just to be able to say everything from your point of view?
It was great. You know, I think part of my personality has been kind of just to stay focused and not talk about things because, you know, you never really get a full conversation to be able to have context. You know, the conversation has to keep moving. And so many of the things that I wanted to talk about, it would take a minute and sit down. And so you're right. It was cathartic. At times it was depressing. Because what do you do, you know, I had a couple of epiphanies writing this book, but, you know, what do you do when, you know, you forgive and forget? And again, this is not just basketball. This is for everyone. What do you do when you forgive and forget? And that's great. That's a process. But what happens when you remember again? And so there are a lot of people that I forgave at 14, 15, 16, and then as a 45-year-old man, I had to remember. Mm-hmm. And kind of going through it or giving yourself a little grace for the mistakes that we made. And like you say, maybe not taking advantage of being around our older ones at that time and saying to yourself, you know what, it's okay. And thank God, you know, my grandfather left me a book and, you know, now you have to do it for your son. Like, what's the good that's going to come out of your regret? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I love, because if you didn't have that, maybe you wouldn't share that with the next generation. And so for me, it was very cathartic. It was holding myself accountable again. And so at those times you have regret of things maybe you could have done better or what you would have done. And then at the end, I'm just really grateful and would sign up for the same thing all over again because it was a wonderful ride. And when we only focus on the outcome and we don't enjoy the journey, a lot of times I think we do ourselves a disservice, our forefathers, like your grandfather, a disservice, you know, because part of what they did was so that we would enjoy the ride, not just so we could become whatever job, you know, we have, but so that we could enjoy the journey from children, family, friends, arts, you know, worship, all those good things. So, yeah, I just really tried to take a whole look, and I just thank the people from my parents, grandparents, teachers that really poured into me.
So I also have a mother who's a teacher, and I read that you journal, like that you've journaled throughout your life. I'm curious if that's something that your parents instilled in you. And how helpful that was when writing this book.
So first, I'm happy for you, and I feel sorry for you.
Yeah, well, I went to my mom's school, unlike you. I had to deal with that.
Oh yeah. So I had to deal with that too early on. Yeah. So much that my first name is Macy, and I would get in trouble. And my mom would call me Macy Chris, and that's how people started calling me Chris. So having a mom at your school is real. Yeah. But so many things that she's done to inspire me, and a lot of it was telling my own story, and a lot of it, too, was the fact of, you know, when we're going through a lot of chaos and you're going through a lot, I think sometimes just being still is waiting is an action. That's another epiphany I got in the book. Waiting is an action because if you have to make yourself stay still just to be in that moment, then we should. And a lot of those times I just kind of wrote down what happened or how I felt at the moment. And it's really great because even when you go back years later, one, you're reminded of what you've gone through. Two, you know that you're not crazy because you felt that way and these things really did happen because, you know, over time we tend to maybe look at things differently and we need a full account. So for me, I've always kept one in this, you know, at times, and it's been really cool looking back over the years.
Yeah, but I find it especially interesting, though, going to write a book. Because I'm guessing that even though you journal, you don't go back and are constantly looking through the journals. And like you said, some of it would be definitely okay. I want to remember how I felt in a moment. And I want to go back to something right. And I want that feeling of, okay, was my memory right? Because you're right. Memory is very, very fallible. And we learn this over and over. Every study that's done on it, it's just, we know what it is. But was there something right. That you read back on now with your perspective and wisdom where you looked back on your younger self as you were writing this book and you felt like, actually, this is harder to face because I was wrong, or I was wrong, I was stubborn, or I missed something? Like, was that one of the more difficult challenges of writing this book and going through those journals?
Yeah, so there are two times specifically, and when I talk about God's grace, I mean great parents, great friends, those, again, that pointing. And so my mother, you know, being a teacher, and she loved sports, but she wasn't, you know, obsessed with it. There were two times in my life in which, you know, my whole life she's been wonderful, but two times in my life in which she had an impact, and I wouldn't think, you know, a soccer mom teacher would have an impact. And that was in going to high school. I wanted to go to high school with Jalen Rose. We were best friends at 12 years old, and we wanted to go to the same high school. We promised ourselves. And so his mom made him go to a whole different school. We lived in the same neighborhood, and my mom made me go to a prep school. It wasn't, you know, for a whole lot of reasons, it isn't where I thought I should be, especially as a teenager with puberty and all that stuff. You know, you shouldn't listen to what a teenager wants. So at this time, I'm going to this school. I'm not going there. You know, the tuition at this high school was more than my parents made. I was intimidated by the situation. And I was told that, you know, I couldn't really chase my dream if I went to this school. And you're 14, 13, so you'll listen to anything anyone says. And so there was about a 2 or 3 year period where I really was upset at my mother for the so-called keeping me away from my dream. Mm-hmm. And going to Country Day High School, the high school I did, was one of the best memories, one of the best decisions. I can't take credit for it, but that was in my life because I've made lifelong friends. The education was great, and sports, we did wonderful as well. And also on the back end, it allowed Jay and I to keep that passion and end up being able to play at Michigan together. And I don't know if we would have played in high school together, would it have been such a thing to want to play together. And the second time, to be real quick, is when I was traded from Washington. I thought that was the worst moment in my career. I wrote that it was worse than a timeout at the time because of Sacramento. It was kind of basketball purgatory. And so I called my father and I'm like, I'm not going. And, you know, he gives me a bunch of man speech, you know, which dad should do. But, you know, I kind of already assumed, you know, what he was going to say, you know, and I called my mom. I'm like, the worst thing in the world has just happened. And she says, oh, it sounds like God just gave you an opportunity to do some great things. And I was so mad that she wasn't as mad as I was about getting traded. And when I look back at Sacramento, it was one of, you know, the best moments. The people there were awesome. My time there was wonderful. And my career wouldn't be what it was without that. And so, you know, yeah, so those couple of times I look back and I regret how I felt. But then again, it really just shows that, you know, I was being watched over in a different way. And so more than the regret of it, I'm just really happy that undeserved I was able to get from so many people.
Yeah. Hey, listen, as someone who's been to Sacramento, I could see that. I could see how you felt that way. I was like, I could understand that initial reaction, leaving the Capitol and going there. I will say this, though, is, you know, you guys had such a likable team in Sacramento that I grew up a huge Seattle Supersonics fan. And even I rooted for you guys, you know, like I think that you guys were unequivocally everybody's second favorite team if you weren't their first favorite team. You know what I mean? Like, the way that you guys played, the ball movement, the characters. I actually just had Bibby on the show about a week and a half ago, getting to talk to him, and it's just like the way that he still talks about Sacramento, the way that he's still connected to Sacramento because of those special memories from that team. It's like that it had a very, very lasting impact on a lot of different basketball fans, especially from that era. I want to actually come back to that in a bit, though, but I do want to say this, like, because, you know, writing this memoir and going back and through those, you know, those memories and the things that happened, how much of this was inspired by you by not being a part of the Fab Five documentary? Because you famously were not involved. And again, when I talked about you not being able to control your own story at times and you being someone who is fairly quiet with the media because there are so many layers and there are so many things to your story that it's like, yeah, man, how, like, what do you have? You're going to go over like 7 hours on a podcast. Like, you're not going to do any of this. You seem like more of a private person, but was part of seeing that documentary or feeling that there was stuff left out or things that you really wanted to say, did that help inspire actually going through this and getting the book done?
Very honestly, great question. That was the impetus of the book. So when the documentary happened, I was really focused on trying to win a championship. And also at the time, things just didn't come together. And so when the story came out and happened, and I did think it was so much that wasn't told, I thought that there was other stories that were just as awesome. I also thought that there was a really lack of reporting on the – it was easy to scapegoat banners and things like that without going in depth. And maybe they didn't have the time. How can you go through all of that? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's when I started writing the book. I started with 12 years ago, about 14 years ago, actually. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine, Peter Gilbert, who famously did Hoop Dreams, I used him for research. I would have him come different places. I would I've interviewed everyone from Coach Fisher to other people. And so I wanted to make sure that I was able to tell the story and honor the guys in other ways as well. And so, yeah, I'm excited about the book, and that's really why I wanted to tell the story. Since then, I've sat down with Jalen on camera, other guys, and you know, we have some wonderful things that are going to come out and telling our story. But yeah, that was the beginning of it. It was a great doc, great storytelling. However, there was a lot of nuance and context that hopefully I can give to people that are interested, because I think if you have that extra context, you'll cry more when I call a timeout. You'll cheer more when you see a highlight of us dunking, because it was so much more than the superficial that was put out. And so hopefully I can fill in with context and give some people some excited behind-the-scenes stories. But, yeah, that definitely was the beginning of me writing this book. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you mentioned that you did sit down with Jalen, and I saw that he promoted the book on social media. Was that the most difficult part for you in writing this, like the two of you hashing everything out and having that time together?
Not at all. That actually was done after the book.
Okay.
Jay and I sat down, and again, I think most people don't, you know, think it starts with the Fab Five with us, mm-hmm. but we've been best friends since 12 years old. And so we have a lot of history and context that really a lot of people couldn't understand. That was not hard. That was not hard at all. I don't think for either one of us, the final moment of us getting together, but these stories, that I tell again, these are kind of my stories, my time with the Fab Five, me growing up. And, you know, we definitely had some fun reminiscing, and we're more so excited about, what Jay and I have coming up in weeks, months, years ahead. We're just excited to, you know, again, to be, for anyone out there, forgiveness is a gift you need to give to yourself. And we don't want to waste time with relations, with regrets and anger. Even if you're 100% right, it really isn't worth it. And so that communication is the key. And this has been a great part of the journey to regain a friendship, you know, at the same time while I was completing the book. So it was wonderful. To tell you the truth, it was wonderful getting back with a friend, and hopefully people can be inspired out there and go do what they need to do to repair relationships in their life.
No, I think that's incredible. And honestly, that might end up being, you know, a part of your legacy. Like, if that ends up happening, like, they ends up staying that way. And I'll tell you this, that you guys have so many fans, right? And you had such a big impact on, you know, culture with the Fab Five, and, you know, people feel like they knew you because they grew up with you. And again, now you get an opportunity to read a book like this and really understand you on a different level if you are a true fan. But, like, I think that actually brings a lot of people happiness and joy that the two of you have found a way to reconcile and get to that space, and then, you know, would very much look forward to the types of content or the things that the two of you want to venture out together. Because, yeah, it's very clear that, you know, both of you guys are, you know, not just accomplished, but really ambitious people who, like you're going to be linked together forever. And so to be, have that in a positive way moving forward, I think like that's very exciting for people to hear, like truly.
Yeah, I mean, just because I beat him in video games all the time and things like that, that shouldn't cause any strife or nothing. No, I hope he hears that and he'll get upset. It's been a great journey. And again, we've been friends forever. And so I'm a fan as well of different relationships. So when Jay and Nas got back together with other people, it was wonderful for me. And we know we mean a lot to people, but people mean more to us. And so hopefully we can bring some enjoyment and some things to people in the near future.
So now there's NIL deals, and obviously had they been in place when you guys were playing, you wouldn't have had to turn the shirts inside out. Like, it would have been okay. You would have been getting paid for the impact that you guys had. But, okay, so student-athletes are making money now. The transfer portal has really changed things, but a lot of people think for the worse. What do you think about the state of college athletes getting paid now? Like, again, most people are happy that student athletes are getting it, but do you think that it has to go somewhere else? Is this going to evolve? Like, what have you thought about as you're watching it?
Well, first of all, I'm happy that the opportunity is there, but you know, as any new industry, you know, it's going to be the wild, wild west in the beginning. So it's like how Bitcoin and everything else just goes crazy. That's what this is going to be like in the beginning. And so I think, you know, I'm glad that it started because it's never going to, nothing ever starts off perfect. But I also think that there are some things that, you know, we have to address. And hopefully it can go to every sport because we're still only talking about, you know, a small percentage of all athletes. Mm-hmm. And though Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese did their thing, all women aren't getting the deals that they're getting and vice versa. And so I think it has a long way to go. But for a long time, the coaches have been in the transfer portal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like you could have a coach when I was recruited. If you sign with the coach on, you know, I'm just making this up, April 2nd, and the coach got – and the coach took a job April 3rd, you still have to go to that college, you know? And so I don't like transfer portals. I don't like kids, you know, naming their price and then taking away from a team. And I mean before they even see the campus and all those things. However, you know, coaches have been doing it. And so I think that universities and coaches and students are going to get together. I believe it's going to be fixed in a better way for everyone. But I don't look at like, wow, this is crazy. I just look at it as the coin has been flipped and, it's been going on with coaches for a while. Transfer. They've been in the transfer portal. Can you imagine what had just happened with Kentucky?
Yeah.
I'm sure he recruited a kid, right? That's the same exact thing. And so I think when the dust settles and kind of everyone sees that it's the same thing, I think some moves will be made to make it more fair for everyone because it has a long way to go, but I'm glad that at least it got started on the students' behalf.
Yeah, the one that got me was right after the University of Washington made it to a college football championship. It's like that's a crowning moment for them. They're so excited there. And then 2 seconds later, Kalen DeBoer, their head coach, is like taking the Alabama job. He's on a plane. He's doing the Alabama thing. And you're like, oh, right. And that's what drove people crazy was the hypocrisy of it, right? There were two things. It was like, you know, stories like yours where it's like, hey, Chris Webber can't afford to get Subway. You know, you're like, that doesn't sit well with anybody. Nobody wants to see that. Wait, okay, so how many people are getting millions and millions and millions? Okay, everyone but him? Okay, well, that's not right. And then, yes, the latitude of coaches to basically be able to treat this like a business when they wanted to and then family when they wanted to. The hypocrisy of that was very, very difficult. But yeah, you're right. It does feel like robber barons right now. Like you said, the Wild West, and it's true. I don't know what it's supposed to be, but I do think that hopefully people like you are in consult with the people that you know, because something it's got to change. I think even just for the development of kids, like going to university should still matter to a degree, right? Like, you are a student athlete, and I don't feel like you being a professionalized person at 19 and going to three different schools and never playing, you know, I just, there's something about it that doesn't feel right in that regard.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny you said, you know, hopefully we have input, but we don't. If you look at all the boards and NCAA and what they're doing, it's a lot of people that did not play and that don't have these things in mind. Because yeah. I agree, whether you go to college 1 year or 4 years, that experience,
yeah.
because I would, that experience, just as being a young adult, you need that, you know? And so from the education on, and there can be a balance. But I think you need honest brokers who have been there before and that can hold people accountable instead of who's on the other board that you know is going to give you a yes all the time. And so hopefully that's what I mean about the conversations, but it's going to have to get a little wilder before, you know, everyone kind of calls for accountability, and then hopefully we'll be brought in and be able to speak up on behalf of those. I mean, there's no way that Spencer Haywood, who was the first athlete to go to the Supreme Court to fight for players coming out early, shouldn't be in those conversations. What made him decide on that? And other players that have been in it. So hopefully, you know, there'll be more of a consortium of those that have been in it. Because the one thing I'm scared of is that we're not going to have college basketball. And what do I mean by that? This is the first year, and I love this part, is that this is the first year that I've known more women basketball players' names.
No question.
And that's because of Steph Curry. Steph Curry equaled the game out between genders by showing how important a three-point shot is. Guys in barbershops used to get ticked off all the time and say, oh, the ladies should lower their basket 9 feet. Now the ladies can say, all right, you want to dunk? Come out here and check me, and I'll shoot it from damn near half court and shut a guy up, you know? So the skill set now is number one, and that's great. But if we don't address it, then there are going to be other options for kids to kind of skip the college option, and that's before going to the league.
Yep.
So I really hope that we save that, because all the tradition in college, the great competition in college, we need to save. But if it's not addressed holistically with heart, character, and passion, and just from a business model, we're definitely going to lose, because the business model other places are better if you don't use the context of the college campus.
Well, that's it. I know, you know, you would say this probably to anybody. It's like, it wasn't just the playing the basketball, like you being at Michigan, right? That college experience, being on the campus, being able to be a college student. Like, I know what that meant to me. And even at the time, like, it's funny too, because, you know, people will say, oh, you're not going to become a professional athlete. Maybe these guys got to get theirs when they got to get theirs. And I'm like, a lot of people go to university and college that don't actually follow through with a profession that they trained to do in college. But then when you get older, you start to realize, like, damn, that was so impactful in terms of who I am and, yeah, like my core personality, my core friends, all these different things. And I genuinely don't want student athletes to lose that. And I don't want it to just become athletes. I still want it to be student athletes. So I do hope they figure out. And I will say this, you know, they might not be asking you now, Chris. You might feel like an outsider in a lot of this, but that is what is so important about, like, your platform and you and Jalen making content together. Is like, the more you speak on that stuff, you know where people are going to hear you. They're not going to hear the people on those boards. Like, they're not going to be weighing in and opining that. It's like your platform in those discussions that can actually cause pressure that will instill change, just like your career ended up having. So I do think that you will, that you can certainly still have a very, very important role to play in this stuff. Before you go, you've been really generous with the time. I do have to ask you this again, as a guy who was rooting very, very hard for the Sacramento Kings. Are you over the Lakers game six? Because it, like, this came up over and over and over, like, with fans nonstop. Like, that now I think we, okay, I think rigged is strong, but I certainly think influenced is fair. And like, when something's out of your control, that sometimes can feel like the hardest thing to give up. So yeah, what are your feelings today about game six against the Lakers?
Well, I definitely write about it in the book.
Yeah.
It's something that my friend Kobe, we used to talk about, and he used to laugh. And so I've shared this privately. We were cheated, period. It's the only time in my life I've ever felt cheated. If you look at the fourth quarter, the fouls, the offensive fouls specifically, the dominance we had that game, the elbow to Bibby's face, and Bibby's bleeding face gets called for a foul against Kobe's elbow.
Yeah.
And we just know, like, yes. But I will have to say this. We could have won game seven, and that's our fault.
Yeah.
So what do I live with? I say, man, you know what? You know, we were one of the best teams. If you know, it had to go up against two of the greatest players ever in Kobe, Shaq, with the greatest coach and the greatest finisher in Ori. So, you know, one, that's that. Two, we got cheated in a series in a game, in game six. And then, you know what? Game seven, we had it home and we lost in overtime. So, you know, there's a lot of levels to truth, and I just try to live within all those levels. And then that takes me back to being as mad as anybody is out there that we got cheated, and it takes me back to being as grateful for having a career, for being able to accomplish a dream, and to be able to have friends that I could call and talk junk on their answer machines and say, leave the ring at my house, and you know, get those little victories, you know, as well. But yeah, man, those are fun times, and hopefully Sacramento can build back up to that so we can go get our rings and start this rivalry all over again.
Hey, Chris, again, it's an incredible career. It's one that continues, again, with your, you know, charitable endeavors and, yeah, again, the music and the broadcast work and now being an author. I can tell how much you put into this thing. Again, I hope people go to your website, chrisweber.com. Again, you can get a copy of this book. It is, there's a limited amount of copies, so I would go and buy it now. You do also get Chris's autograph in the book, which I think is a really nice personal touch. But yeah, it obviously was a very difficult and emotional experience for you. And congrats on that, man. And again, I really do hope that it does well. But I hope that, yeah, your friends and family and the people that you wrote it for, that they really care about it the most. Thanks so much for your time, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. And anybody that listens to this interview, you're hearing something in your head that you're supposed to be doing, just start it. And just start it. You'll finish it, but start it. Start it now. Start it now. Thank you, JD. I appreciate it, man. It's always fun talking with you.
There he is, Chris Webber. I actually really like that he closed on that. It's true. Start it. Do it. I know I feel that way a lot of times, where something that I don't do becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger thing, snowballs, until it feels like it's completely unapproachable. And then when I start doing it, almost always, I feel better immediately. And it's almost never as bad as you build it up in your mind. And the longer that you let it build up, I think the more difficult it becomes to tackle. So, yeah, great perspective from Chris. I really did enjoy talking to him. Again, it's got to be kind of tough being able to do, a project like that takes so many years when so many people have had their opinions on you. Let's take a quick break. Let's come back and hit what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So, some breaking news. Apparently, according to TMZ and his official Twitter account, O.J. Simpson has passed away. And all I got to say about that is, what a shame. Anyway, Jay's bullpen last night, they had to turn to Tim Mazza. And right now he stinks, and he's talking about stuff like soul-searching, which is not great at this point of the season, because going into this year, there was a lot of talk about Tim Mazza being underrated and underappreciated and really important to this bullpen. And I get it. I'm trying to be patient because they've got some missing arms. But yeah, you're going to deal with injuries throughout the course of a season. And I'm, quite frankly, not exactly sure what we're going to be getting from some of these guys when they do return. So there's some guys in Buffalo right now. That's great. Does feel like reinforcements are on the way. But yeah, Tim Mazza has now conceded runs in 4 of his 8 outings. Whew. Not what you want to see. Not what you want to see if you're a Toronto Blue Jays fan. So one of the things that's supposed to be the strength of this team, one of the things that's supposed to be the thing that they're building this team around is pitching depth. And yeah, Mazza aside, I've been feeling that lack of depth. Yimi Garcia aside, he's been phenomenal. Yimi is passing the eye test. He's getting the results. He looks awesome. Green has been, to me, okay. He's one of those guys that right now is clearly slotted in the wrong role. He's not meant to be a closer. Never was, never will be. But outside of that, yeah, I haven't felt great about the rest of the pen. And Yeah, I'm really, really hoping that the reinforcements end up taking care of some of that. The one thing, too, is if they don't get Bowden Francis on track and they got to use Yariel Rodriguez as a starting pitcher, that complicates things as well. So, again, Bowden Francis, next start, fairly big one. All right, let's do it. What did we miss? I want to do player pool. You told me to
do the player NHL pool. Do you want to touch on the wild card series banner that some Jays fans noticed hanging in the Rogers Center? What are your thoughts?
Okay, I thought about it for a bit. I saw the posts. Don't really have that big of an issue with it, to be honest.
Yeah, no big deal.
It's like, listen, again, we're the city that hung a Bon Jovi banner.
The Rays have it hanging too.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems like something we do now. It was always make the playoffs, you have a banner, and I get it that making the playoffs doesn't mean the same thing, but I just don't think that that's embarrassing. It's only embarrassing because of the ways they went out, right? Like the fact that they haven't won any of those games. They have the pandemic one up there against the Rays?
Yeah, 2020, 2022,
yeah, 2023. Yeah, that one's a little, but whatever. What are you going to do? I don't know. Here's what I'd say. If it was up to me, I probably wouldn't do it. I'd probably be like, no, you got to make a divisional series to hang a banner. That would probably be, I'd say, like, let's have a standard here. It does feel, I understand it because when you're looking at it, maybe you say, oh, wow, that's the new standard to get up in the rafters is just make it to the wild card. It feels like the standard is being shrunk or that this is a way for the guys that are currently here to have a marking of their what they accomplished. But I would say this is like if that's all they end up accomplishing, then it will become a joke. But if it does turn into a DS win and, you know, a playoff run this year, I think all that stuff ends up kind of getting normalized and people look back on it and it's like, oh, that year sucked and that year was this and that year was fine, right? So I really don't think it's worth crying over. I don't. This is really with the Toronto Blue Jays this year, it's just got to be pick your battles a bit, okay? You got to pick your battles just a little bit because this team is going to be frustrating and there's clearly a lot of baggage that is carried over. And so to me, like hanging a banner, like this isn't the Colts hanging the banner for Deflategate the year after they lost to the Patriots. It's not the Bon Jovi banner. Like other teams would do that too. I don't know. I really don't have that much of a problem with it. I really don't. I wish I could. I wish I could muster some, you know, fake anger over this, some manufactured anger over this, but I don't feel that way. It doesn't move me that way. It's just there. It just hangs. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. It's a little embarrassing. You make a crack about it. Maybe, you know what, too? When you're at the ballpark, you just want to have, like, things to talk about with your friends. And I'm sure you already got a lot, but you look up at that thing, and you might have a memory of how that sucked, and that's part of the experience, too. You talk about it with a friend, whatever. Move on. Have a Bud Light. Keep going. All right, what's next?
Okay, so the NHLPA put together their annual poll. 639 NHL players were surveyed. I'm going to ask you a few questions, and you're going to try to predict pretty much what the players thought.
Sure.
First one, if you need to win one game, what forward do you want on your team? I don't want you to just give me number one because that's obvious. I want you to try to give me 1 to 5 what they have.
1 to 5?
No, not listed, just like the names.
No, I'm going to give you literally who I'm guessing is. I should have talked about this with you before. I'm going to try to guess who the players picked.
Yep.
So one player to win a game.
One forward.
I'm going to say that it's McDavid 1.
Correct.
I bet you it's Sid 2.
Yep.
And right. I bet you it's McKinnon 3.
That is all correct, sir. Yep.
Okay.
You want to go 4 and 5?
Who's
no?
Wait. Yeah, I do. I want to keep going on this one just because I'm curious if Matthews cracked the list. Okay. So those three, because I think that's kind of easy. So it's one player though, right?
One player. Yeah.
Makar?
One forward.
Oh,
one
no, it's forward. Okay, yeah, it's forward. Yeah. Okay, it's forward. It's forward. It's forward. Because I was going to guess Makar and Hedman. One forward. Matthews 4?
Nope.
Kucherov 4?
Correct.
Matthews 5?
No.
Yeah, see, these guys are so salty. Anyway, whatever. Who's 5?
Panarin got the call for number 5.
Oh, that's so salty. That's so salty, these players. By the way, I just want to let people know. Guess the theme of these player polls when I'm doing some of these guesses. Okay, what's the next category? I think that was pretty good. What'd I get? 4 or 5?
Yeah, you got 4 or 5.
Four or five.
If you need to win a face-off, who would you pick? This one was a little tougher.
Sid.
Sid's number 2.
O'Reilly?
Yeah. Ryan O'Reilly is number 1, 15% of the total vote. Anyways, I thought that was interesting.
Tavares?
Nope, Tavares not there.
Interesting.
Claude Giroux?
Yeah, that's
Jordan
a good one.
Stahl?
Yeah, Stahl. Stahl was going to be my next. Anyway, all right. So No Tavares on this list. Okay, got it. All right, what's next?
Which arena is the toughest to play in as a visiting team?
Bell Center.
Nope. Bell Center's number five.
Five?
Yeah. Think current, I guess, like...
Hold on. Yeah. Give me a second with this. Toughest arenas to play in, Bell Center is five.
Yeah.
TD Garden?
TD Garden's number three.
Okay, that's weird. Okay, so this is a compelling radio me trying to think about the arena names.
Well,
Vegas?
Vegas is number one. That's correct. 32% of the vote, so it's pretty big majority.
You know why I said that, though? Is because I was like, his guys are boozing and hanging out. Like, is it really that hard to play in Vegas? Anyway, what are the other ones?
I guess recency bias. And number two is PNC Arena.
I was gonna say, like, is it one of the, you know, is it Calgary? Is it Edmonton?
No.
Though
they didn't even crack the top five.
Yeah, so they didn't pick any Canadian markets. All right, fine. That's embarrassing to Canada that we only got one then. One of five?
Yeah, one of five.
Sorry, what was the two?
Two was Carolina.
Oh, shut up. Shut up. These guys are salty players. What's next?
And then Ball Arena made the top five too in Denver. I don't know.
That checks out because I actually should have guessed that just because altitude as well. That's the reason why I guessed Vegas was because I was like, what are the outside factors? I should have guessed. I'm actually mad at myself today. The thing is I actually don't know I wouldn't have known what the Colorado Arena is called. Ball Arena?
Ball Arena.
Yeah, okay. What's next?
All right, this one's a little trivial, but which player has the best swag?
Oh, I don't care. I don't know. Pasternak?
Yep.
Marner?
No Marner in there.
Of course.
We got Willie and Austin Matthews in there.
I was going to say. I was literally about to guess. Okay, so the Leafs got style ones.
That's
okay, cool.
The only ones the Leafs
No,
did.
Don't. You ruined it. What are you doing? You suck at trivia. You're never going to be the next out.
What, do you want to guess a couple more of the best swags?
No, I want to guess the other. What other categories are there?
Okay, let's do which player is the most difficult to face in their own end?
Hedman.
Yep, that's correct. Number one.
Yeah.
And then, any others?
Trouba?
Nope.
In their own end. So defenseman.
Yeah. I mean, one of them's not a defenseman.
Okay. So then it's okay.
McDavid is the only non-defenseman that made the list. Cale Makar.
Okay. This is stupid. That category is dumb. Next.
Why don't we do, who is the best breakout passer in the game?
Makar.
Correct. Yep. 27%.
Quinn Hughes.
Yep.
Morgan Riley.
Nope, he didn't make the list.
Wow. Interesting stuff. So he didn't make the list. Huh? Okay, what's next?
Which player do you least enjoy playing against but would like to have on your own team?
Huh. Least playing against, I got to guess this is Marchand.
Yes, 30%, almost.
30%, almost that's a 30, good. That's a whopping number. Who's two? Trouba?
Connor McDavid.
Oh, okay. This is so. These guys just threw McDavid up on everything. Okay.
Matthew Tkachuk.
Oh, damn it. Why didn't I guess Tkachuk? Yeah, I was going to say Tkachuk. Yeah. Okay. What's next?
Tom Wilson, Nathan MacKinnon. I did that one. Who's the most complete player?
McDavid.
Nope.
MacKinnon?
Sid got the nod at number one.
Okay. Fine. Yeah. All right.
MacKinnon and McDavid, number four and five.
Okay. Anything else?
Barkov and Kopitar.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, I think I did okay, I'm guessing. No Leafs. Wonder why the jealous ones were so jealous. Anyway, subscribe to the podcast, leave five stars, and we'll see you tomorrow.